Hello and welcome to episode one of the Poolside Pass podcast. My intended purpose for this podcast is for me to document some of my CPD going forward in the terms of club visits and discussions with other coaches. I thought it might be useful for other coaches to perhaps hear these discussions as well, because ultimately coaching is all about sharing, so people don't have the time and their busy work schedules to engage in formal CPD, and this podcast may be of use to them. In today's episode, I'm joined by Chris Littler, the assistant coach at City of Birmingham, a friend, colleague, and mentor of mine for a few years now. I wanted to kick this podcast off with Chris because he had the opportunity back in December 2018 to travel to Japan with British Swimming to observe the Japanese National Development Camp. In this episode, we'll be hearing from Chris about his experiences out in Japan and what he's implemented into his coaching now. So, I think it's about time I introduced Chris. Chris, thanks for coming on the first episode.
No problem.
Why don't you just tell us, first of all, a little bit about your background, how you got into coaching, and what your current role is.
So, when I was younger, I swam at Bodmin Swimming Club, which is a club just north Birmingham. They're a feeder club to City of Birmingham. I swam at a regional standard. I wasn't anything flash. regional finalist, and that's about it, really. While I was there, I volunteered teaching and coaching between the ages of 16 and 18 before going off to university at Sheffield Hallam. There I studied sport development with coaching, and it was only kind of during my second year on my placement that I realised, yeah, sport development is not for me. I wanted to work within my passion, which was coaching. So in my final year, I decided to live from home, and I coached at Bolmer during that final year. And I'd travel into university in Sheffield on the train. So following university, I then went back and coached even more at Bolmer before being approached by Carl Grosvenor, head coach of City of Birmingham. And at the time, in 2011, he then offered me a place coaching the brand new development squad at City of Birmingham for 2012. Since then, I've coached at Birmingham. And in 2016, I moved up to the position of junior coach when Adam Taylor moved on from the post. And within my tenure as junior coach, I've coached swimmers to British summer medals, but also to Great Britain representation.
Awesome. So tell us a bit about how you came across the opportunity to go to Japan with British Swimming.
So to be honest, it came as a bit of a surprise. It was dropped as a bit of a bomb on me. I was part of the Swim England Pathway Coach Development Programme for almost 12 months, and that kind of came to a close towards the back end of 2018. And about early December of last year, in 2018, I all of a sudden received an email inviting me to go on this trip to Japan. 2 weeks' notice, so I was a bit shocked. And the invitation apparently was put forward by Swim England following my place on that Pathway Coach Development Programme. So that's how I was selected. I'm very privileged to do so.
Sounds like you're impressed on other things you've been on.
Well, I hope so. I like to think so.
I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the purpose of the trip from a British swimming perspective. What's the reason behind going out to Japan, etc.
So the trip first started in 2014. It was only a small group that went out there to this Japan National Development Camp. It was comprised of Tim Jones, Sean Kelly as coach, and the swimmers involved were Luke Greenbank, Charlie Atwood, Martin Walton, and Duncan Scott. If you've really kicked on to represent GB and win international medals, it's a very intense camp, male only, and it's kind of targeted at their junior national swimmers. And initially, the camp was used by British Swimming as exposure to the culture and environment of Japan pre-Tokyo 2020. So obviously, that's worked out really well for people like Duncan Scott, who are likely going to be going and challenging for medals in 2020. But since then, it's also been used as similar exposure for other swimmers of a similar level, of that junior national level from within Britain, as well as other coaches. So that's a little bit about the background of the trip.
Cool. Just want to get into a little bit around kind of the culture out in Asia. I know it's very different to how perhaps we're used to in Western society. First of all, maybe not necessarily linked to culture as such, but you know, there's a huge time difference between the UK and Tokyo. How did the swimmers cope with this? Was there any way of offsetting those differences and dealing with it? Or was it just straight in and get going straight away?
I mean, we were sent out a little bit of information by British Swimming in advance as to how to deal with travel. More so the hygiene of it. There wasn't very, very much in the way of understanding the time difference and jet lag, etc. However, it was kind of advocated that getting to bed at a decent time, even if you're not tired, and trying to get a decent night's sleep on that first night. But we actually had very little time to adapt to it, because we had the day we landed, we had the afternoon / evening, and then the next day we had a travel / tourist day in Tokyo, which was great. We got to see loads of sights, loads of different places that you've probably seen on TV. But then following that day, the next morning we were off on the bullet train from Tokyo to Suzuka, which is where the camp was taking place. The camp was actually located about 2 miles away from the F1 circuit in Suzuka. Okay. Massive facility, etc. But yeah, the time difference was, they have very little time to get used to it, but were forced into it by the camp due to the routine of the camp. So yeah, swimmers did struggle initially, but they didn't have much choice other than to get over it, really.
Right, so kind of moving on from that, you know, you're going across, going intercontinental on this camp. I know everyone knows that the food out in Asia is very different to what we eat here, and even when we eat kind of Asian food here, it's still a million miles away from what they actually eat. Were there any challenges associated with this in terms of management of swimmers on the camp and their nutrition?
Well, I think that the food was very simple. I think we were limited with what we did eat, so it may have seemed even more simple than it actually is. But yeah, there was lots of rice, a mix of veg, a mix of meat. But the main challenge that we had was that everything, or almost everything, out in Japan and Asia is cooked with soy sauce, or cooked with soy. And one of the swimmers that went on the camp had a gluten intolerance and therefore couldn't have anything with soy. So not everywhere catered for that. All the eating establishments that we went to within Tokyo, we had to go to various different ones before we found somewhere we could eat. And the majority of them tended to be places that just did plain steak as well as rice and bits of veg. But it was really basic in what we had to eat, and that also posed challenges on the camp itself. The camp itself had buffet style and very similar every day, but that swimmer that had a gluten intolerance, they had to have meat bought individually from them from supermarkets almost on a daily basis, so it wasn't cooked with soy.
Wow, so it's... would you say that in terms of that kind of thing, was the camp aware ahead of time that was the case, or was it something that...
No, the camp wasn't aware ahead of time. I'm not sure if they tried to communicate that at all. British Swimming were aware that this lad had a gluten intolerance, and they gave him some advice before going out. He'd travelled abroad previously towards Asia on a competition before. So he had a laminated sheet which had, or listed, his intolerance in Japanese, which he carried around with him to various different places, which he had to hand to whoever it was that was serving us to see whether they'd actually cater for him. But no, other than that, the camp itself didn't know, but they were actually really accommodating, and Kev Renshaw was the team leader, and one of the members of staff from Japanese swimming, took him to the shops several times to buy this meat for this lad.
So in terms of the restrictions on what could be eaten and what they were serving, did it affect the swimming in any way? Was there any meals where they had to kind of go without or eat something that potentially wasn't optimal for their nutrition?
No, not really, other than this one lad who was struggling with food choices based on the largely soy diet. The other lads, none of them struggled with the food. There was lots of rice consumed, sometimes plates of it at one meal. But no, none of them had an issue, and I think it served its purpose in terms of fueling them for the session and for the camp. But yeah, it was basic, but it did the job.
I guess when you're doing big volumes of work, plates of rice aren't always a bad idea.
No, and I think, it was, nobody got upset stomachs, that's for sure. So it was all good.
So moving on then from nutrition, were there any culture differences in terms of the way their camp ran compared to how perhaps some of our national camps might run?
So in terms of the structure of the camp compared to that of a Swim England national event camp, the structure of it wasn't much different. You know, there was a morning session, there was an afternoon session, there was some land work based stuff, and then you had your morning meal, your lunch, your evening meal. So other than that, there wasn't a huge difference. Obviously, it was a longer camp. It was a 9-day camp, 7 training days. So it was a longer camp, but the structure remained similar. It was intense. I think it was designed to be an intense training camp, so I'm not sure whether that was just a snapshot of what all camps are like, or whether that camp differs to some of the other ones. That's not something we were able to get our hands on and understand. But yeah, the camp itself was very intense. Despite the language, their session plans were written in English, but they call them menus, which are a bit different.
Can't imagine it was a great choice that you don't usually get on a menu. It was very...
Yeah, not for the distance guys, especially. But no, it was very hierarchical as well. So there was a head coach who basically did nothing throughout the entire camp. He gave an introduction at the start of the camp on day one and gave a debrief on day nine. Other than that, he didn't really do much. In the first and the very last session, everybody was in together doing quite a generic session, and he was setting people off over a microphone every 5 seconds or 10 seconds. And yeah, other than that, he did absolutely nothing. And it was down to the individual groups, their lead coach, to dictate what they were doing within the training camp itself. And each lead coach had assistants. So it was quite hierarchical in that sense. Swimmers themselves are very compliant. The culture itself is a very compliant culture. They follow things to the letter. Don't know if any of you have been to Japan or Tokyo. If you go to their subway, for example, you have to line up within these painted lines on the floor, depending on which subway you're getting on. And you're not allowed to... Well, it's frowned upon if you walk and eat. You should be standing or sitting still to be eating in public. You must take rubbish with you. You can't... there aren't really any bins. You take them with you until you find a bin. So it's a very clean, very compliant culture, and that came across in the swimmers themselves. Whatever they were told that they were doing, whatever set they were given, whatever turnaround, they got on and did it, even if there was a mistake. I remember one of the sessions, one of the coaches had written a mistake on the turnaround, but they just got on with it. Nobody raised it. Nobody said, I think this turnaround might be wrong. They just pushed off, missed turnaround, and it was the coach ended up having to reset them and explain that it was the wrong turnaround. So, compliance, that was a massive one, compliance with the swimmers. There was one other interesting cultural part of the camp itself. And that was every evening, all the swimmers would have a public bath time. So this was at the facility itself. There was a bathing, public bath, spa type area. And they call them sentos in traditional Japan. So all these swimmers, they go for this bath in the evening. It's almost ritualistic, and they have to strip off completely, which was a little bit of a shock for our swimmers, and I think quite a bit of hesitation on that first night, but they seemed to return a few times, so it wasn't such a bad thing.
It's not something you'd associate with... well, you wouldn't expect anyone within a Western culture to feel very comfortable with doing that kind of thing.
No, but it's so lodged in their tradition and history. These sentos have been around for hundreds of years, and yeah, it's just part of their tradition, so they don't see it as anything other than normal. So our lads going over there, all of a sudden having to strip off in front of a load of other lads, just to have sit in a public bath, like a spa type jacuzzi. I think they found that a little bit uncomfortable initially, but kind of got their head around it once they realised that it was part of the culture and embraced it. So, interesting.
I just want to get kind of an idea about the scale of the size of the camp. So when we have our kind of national event camps, you know, granted they're a little bit shorter, they're not 7 days in length, they're a few days, but we have kind of a breaststroke and fly group at one venue, we have free and medley at another venue, backstroke elsewhere, etc. Do they have everything under kind of one roof?
Yeah, so this was essentially the best kids in Japan, ranging from ages 15 through to 18. And it was across all strokes. The groups were split. So the groups themselves were split based on stroke. The medley group and the breaststroke group were also split by age, which kind of fits with Japanese strengths in world swimming. They're very prevalent on medley and very prevalent on breaststroke. So the fact that they'd split that by age also showed that they're really focusing on it at a junior age as well. So they'd have a junior high school group, which was like, I think they actually went younger than 15 in those groups, and it was like 14 through to 16, and then 17, 18 on the senior high school. So other than that, they had a massive swimmers. There was, I can't remember how many swimmers there was now, but you're probably looking at around 90 swimmers. Wow. Across the entire camp, and they did split it so that some of the groups would be in early morning, early afternoon, and then the other groups would be in late morning, late afternoon, and they'd do half the camp like that and then reverse it over, so the early groups would then go to the late groups, just to provide a little bit more space and split the groups up a bit better. But yeah, it was all under one roof essentially, and it was just structured to allow that to be spread out throughout the day and throughout the camp.
Oh, sounds like a big project to manage and oversee for Japanese swimming, really. Just want to get into kind of a bit more specifically around their training, how they go about their business. Do you feel there were any differences between how we train in the UK, our methods, our philosophy behind it, and then how they operate out in Japan? Were there any striking differences for you?
So, as I say, it was a snapshot. It was a 9-day intense training camp. How that applies to their everyday training back in their home programs, not entirely sure. But essentially, you know, I saw 14 sessions. Of those sessions, 2.5 hours was the duration of the morning session. 2 hours was the duration of the evening session. The groups were split by stroke, as I've said. Now, again, my view of it was based around where the British swimmers fell. So the British swimmers fell into the distance freestyle group. We had three swimmers that fell into that. All represented GB by that point on distance free. We also had one lad who was in the breaststroke group, which was good to see. The fact that was such a big focus of theirs. So, in terms of the differences in training philosophies and methods, what I saw from both groups, both the distance free and the breaststroke, was that all of those groups were high volume, but especially the distance freestyle group. So distance freestyle group on the 2.5 hour morning sessions, they'll be going 9-10K, and then they go a little bit more kind of specific test set or race pace on the evening. Something like a 3100s best average off 120, I think it was, a long course. So that was pretty brutal. It's basically a threshold set, but it's just best average suited, brutal. Whereas the breaststroke group, there was a little bit more kind of variety in there. There was a little bit more kind of specific stuff. And they were quite open to speaking to Kev Renshaw and finding out a little bit about his ways of working and trying different things based on what he said. And that was just during the camp. That wasn't like, it was something that they'd asked pre getting started over the camp. So they kind of changed their philosophy a little bit through the camp as they went through it based on Kev speaking to them. Which I found interesting, that they didn't seem really set in what they were trying to work on, what they were trying to focus on. In terms of the content of those sessions, obviously that was the volume was high, but the content, again, especially that distance freestyle group, lots of time was spent at short rest, what we'd consider 40 beats below max, big volume, and of that, lots of it was done as pull. They'd be doing a large variety of pull across all four strokes, long course, off short turnarounds, again, working hard, roughly around 40 beats below max. So those are kind of philosophy or differences in philosophy across the groups, that the distance free seemed very set in what they were doing, whereas the breaststroke group seemed a little bit more open to varying things slightly. But there was still high volume and plenty of time spent at that 40 beats below.
So in terms, like, I know you mentioned that sessions are very, very high volume. Was there much focus around technical training or developing skills and technical attributes within swimmers, or was it just all hard work?
So I think you have to look at the coaching style of the coaches that were there, mainly the lead coaches, but also the assistants. I wouldn't call them coaches per se. I think one of the conversations I had with Kev was, we see them more, or saw them more, as trainers. They wrote a session on their menu, gave it to the swimmers, and the swimmers got on with it, and there was very little intervention in terms, they weren't picking people up on anything off, i.e. if somebody wasn't doing a good enough job off their walls, they wouldn't pick up on it. It'd just be literally ploughing up and down and just getting through it. As I say, there was a little bit different with the breaststroke group, particularly the junior high school group. There was a little bit more focus on technical aspects. So whether that kind of ties into what they do at a younger age in their learn to swim programs and club programs, with being a bit more technical with their breaststroke, they did tend to spend more time on technique. They also did drills across all groups. There were drills within every set. However, the majority of drills I didn't feel had much substance to them. A lot of them seemed to be quite what I call fancy drills. The
drills for drill's sake.
Yeah, exactly. So they weren't really purposeful. They were more kind of just there for variety.
We need to do some drills, we'll do this.
Yeah. So I think there were a few interesting drills that I thought might be useful. I tried a few of them out since coming back, but yeah, on the whole, the drills that they were selecting weren't necessarily fit for purpose or really targeted at addressing anything. As I say, the breaststroke group, far more technical. Their physical attributes of Japanese swimmers kind of lend themselves towards breaststroke anyway. You know, their stature's quite short, their limb length's quite short, they've got big quads.
Very powerful.
Very powerful, and as a result, they're very fast with their recovery, they're fast with their leg kick, getting their feet round. So that was interesting to see. Distance free, very different outlook on distance freestyle compared to what Western swimming would suggest. So their view of it is keeping flat hips, very much shoulder driven, recovering quite wide, and their reasoning for that was to try and keep the hips more level to aid with buoyancy, which I found quite interesting. However, when you're getting people to do like 9-10k in the morning and then like 6k at intensity on a night, and you're doing it all shoulder driven, for me that's putting a lot of strain through the shoulders. You're not getting great distance per stroke, so I didn't agree with it at all. And I think speaking to Kev as well, it, you know, we didn't agree with it, and it's kind of ties in with, well, where are Japanese distance freestylers on an international level? You know, I think their outlook is very different, and I don't think it's quite come to fruition for them. So, yeah, I suggest that what we do in Western culture suits better. But it was an interesting outlook, which was worth asking about for sure.
Yeah, cool. I know, obviously, you know, you're a swimming coach first and foremost, but you've also got personal training qualification as well that sits alongside that. Did you make any observations from the way they work on land? Did you see anything that you thought was quite interesting, anything you've brought back into the way you work as well?
So, I mean, even without personal training qualification, it was obvious to see that they spend zero time weight-bearing exercises. There's no gym on site. There's no any sort of dumbbells, barbells, whatever, kettlebells, med balls. There's nothing. All of their exercises are body weight or flexibility and mobility. So they'd spend 30 minutes pre and 30 minutes post each session, both morning and afternoon, working on mobility and stability pre-session and flexibility post-session. And of their flexibility work, it was very intense stretching, all partner stretching, or almost all partner stretching. And by intense, I mean they were pushing themselves to a point of discomfort. And yeah, viewing the swimmers, they've all got what we'd probably associate a diving or gymnastics level of flexibility, which clearly lends itself to breaststroke and meddling. I saw very few people with injuries there as well, which probably helped. But yeah, all swimmers were very mobile through their hips, very mobile through all lower body joints. But also, you know, if their approach for distance free is very shoulder driven, they're also quite mobile through their shoulders, which probably helped to limit the impact of injury on that. So that's the one thing I observed, just the amount of time that they spent dedicating to mobility and flexibility in particular. And that's something I've tried to bring back into my program since I've come back. Just spending a little bit more time and attention on pre and post pull in terms of mobility and flexibility.
I think the points you're making there about flexibility and mobility are actually very important. Personally, I don't think it's something that we're very good at. I don't think we have very flexible athletes. I think, you know, we're at national championship this week, and we're seeing people that actually can't get into great streamline. We're seeing people that aren't able to get into great positions on the block. And I think, you know, flexibility, mobility kind of work really plays into that a lot.
Yeah, completely. I think the one thing I'd say on that is I don't think that we're educated particularly well on flexibility. You know, I think we, within our qualifications and our CPDs of swimming, we spend a lot of time looking at swimming, and we see that, well, on a start position, knee greater hamstring flexibility. Well, it's where do we get that kind of information as to how to improve stretching? Unless you've done some sort of land-based qualification, you don't have an idea of how to really do that, and, well, certainly do it effectively. So that's one thing I'd say, is just that the awareness and knowledge required in order to improve flexibility probably isn't there, and would need looking at. Obviously, some of the stuff I've seen out in Japan, it's great. I think we're also a little bit hesitant to do it when we don't have that experience and certainly knowledge in terms of working with our athletes to increase their flexibility. I think we're quite good at giving them maintenance stretches, but very little in the way of developmental stretching. So I think, yeah, what I saw out in Japan, I've got a good knowledge base now. It's just being afraid to do it, I think, for some people. The fact that even if they do know, they don't want to do it for...
Fear of injury,
exactly. So,
yeah. I think it's either British Swimming or Swim England are currently developing a land work qualification for coaches. I'd be interested to see if that has incorporated in it work specifically on flexibility and mobility that falls away from the typical RMAP exercises that we see.
It's well needed.
Cool. So just before we sign off the podcast, just kind of want to get you to kind of summarize your experience and just give us three things that you've taken away from your experience going out to Japan that you've implemented into the way you work now back at Birmingham.
Yeah, so the first thing being the need for more attention to mobility and flexibility in pre and post pool. Obviously I've touched on that, but that's a key one for me, like seeing how good they are and how well it applies to certain things that they do within the pool and certain things they do in terms of skill. Definitely need for more of that, and something I'm definitely doing more of pre and post pool. I think as well, it was my second point, it was really, really useful having Kev Renshaw as team leader. Obviously someone that's worked with, not just worked with international athletes, but also coach people to Olympic medals. No, it's the world records. Somebody with that experience to pick their brains on what their thoughts are of it was really interesting. We had in-depth discussions about the Japanese way of doing things in terms of spending so much time at mid-range intensity, so that short rest, the lack of need for it, and kind of the data that he's got based on world-class athletes like Katie Ledecky, Pellegrini, who've dominated women's swimming, particularly women's freestyle. So they did hell of a lot of low-end aerobic work, but at high skill. So I think that's definitely something I've tried to implement into my program a lot more since coming back from that. So I put a lot of that down to my conversations with Kev while I was out there. Finally, as a very compliant culture, that's highlighted that's not us, that's not Western culture. That's very much a Japanese and Asian cultural difference. So relating that back to what I do and what we do in Britain, it just highlights the need for communication and building relationships with your athletes.
Absolutely.
Making sure that you understand them, and not just understand them, but understand that the culture that we live in, everything's changing, everything's different. Like 5 years' time, the culture that we live in will have changed slightly. And I think it's important that we really adapt with that and understand the individual's needs in order to help build relationships with our athletes and get more out of them individually. So that was the third thing I've taken away, and I do spend a lot more time kind of with my athletes and understanding them than I perhaps have done in previous years. So yeah, those are my three points.
That's really good, and thank you for your insights into your experience out in Japan, and thank you for being my first guest on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
Hope you've enjoyed reflecting and kind of passing on some of your thoughts and insights into your experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm absolutely honoured to have been selected to be part of that trip. You know, it's something I never imagined I'd be doing when I started coaching. So I'm very grateful to British Swimming. And thanks for having me on your podcast to talk about it.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you for coming on.
Pleasure.
So that brings us to the end of episode 1 of the Poolside Pass podcast. I hope you found the conversation with Chris interesting and informative. If you like the podcast, please subscribe, as well as checking out the blog at www.thepoolsidepass.blogspot.com. If you have any ideas for potential guests for the podcast, or perhaps you would like yourself to feature in the podcast, please get in touch. But for now, take care.